My castaway this week is an entertainer. She has, in fact, entertained a whole generation from the time when, as a young girl, she was chosen to sing in Trafalgar Square on VE night to the moment earlier this year when she returned to the West End stage to play the lead in Sunset Boulevard. She's the biggest female recording star Britain has ever produced, popular not only here, but in France and America too. But to the British public, who remember her from her first radio programmes in the 40s and hits such as The Little Shoemaker in the 50s and Downtown in the 60s, this sophisticated millionairess will always be our pet. She is Petula Clark. It's a very affectionate handle, Petula, our pet. But do you resent it in a way? Do you feel, oh, why don't the British let me grow up?
No, I don't resent it. But I think I'm getting on a bit to be called our pet, you know.
But I suppose it's the price you pay as a child star, isn't it? People feel very proprietorial about you.
It wasn't easy for me because As I was growing up in public, which was not a very easy thing to do. I think growing up's tricky anyway, but, you know, doing it in front of millions of people is really bad news. But, of course, every time I wore a dress that showed a little bit of cleavage or when I got out of my little white socks, people were not happy. They could see their own youth disappearing with
mine. Do you
think
that's what it was?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, if you were growing up, they must be old.
That's right, yeah.
But it must have been a great liberation when you eventually went to France in your 20s and suddenly you started to sing in front of an audience with whom you didn't carry all that child star baggage, as it were.
Yes, but, you know, there's this sort of idea that I went to France to escape all of that. It didn't happen like that at all. I happened to fall in love with a Frenchman, much to my surprise. And we had to live somewhere, and he couldn't speak English. Not that I could speak French, of course, but, I mean, I somehow felt that I could manage it. And I went to live in France, but it was, if I was going to run away to anywhere, the last place would have been France, I can tell you.
The British, of course, were bereft when you went. And they got quite anti-French about it, really,
I know
didn't
they did.
They?
I know.
Anybody think you'd married de Gaulle or something?
I know, yes. Our pet going off to marry a Frenchman. Yeah. But it was good for me.
And you created a different image, and then you created a different image again when you went to the States after that. Mm-hmm. Can you define the three images? I think we know about our pet. what was the French thought you were sexy?
Well, yes, they did, but they thought I was very amusing, too, because I had this very strange accent. And they found it very charming, and they liked the way I sang. They'd never heard anyone sing like that before in French.
And what about in the States? What was your image there, ultimately?
Very gutsy. A lot of the people before they saw me thought I was black because my name, Petula, sounded rather exotic, I suppose.
But where do you feel most at home when you perform? In Britain, in France, or in the States?
Oh, well, here, of course. You know, this is home.
Tell me about your first record that you'll take to your desert island.
This is a song from Blood Brothers. It's me singing. Am I allowed one?
Of course.
You know, I wouldn't normally choose one of mine, but Blood Brothers was a wonderful experience for me. I performed it on Broadway a couple of years ago for 10 months, and it was a fantastic experience. I got very involved in it, and I found out a lot about myself playing Mrs. Johnston, who's a Liverpudlian, and she has 7 kids at the beginning of the show, and she's expecting twins, and she's had a rough life, and I enjoy playing her very much.
Tell me it's not true, though it's here before me. Say it's just a dream. Say it's just a scene from an old ago.
Tell me it's not true, from the musical Blood Brothers, sung by my castaway Petula Clark, who had great success in that part on Broadway for about 10 months, and then a very long tour in the States. So tell me now, what was the attraction of Sunset Boulevard and Norma Desmond? What was the attraction of that part for you?
Well, I didn't think it was very attractive at first, quite honestly. I didn't really want to do it.
What, faded movie star?
Well, no, it's not. Well, it's, I don't know. I had seen it on Broadway with Glenn Close, and I thought it was very good. But, you know, I never saw myself in that role at all. I couldn't see myself playing this monstrous woman, you know.
How did you feel when you first saw yourself in the full makeup? Because it's very severe, isn't it, with the turban, not a hair showing, and then this very pale face and the blood-red lips.
Well, that helped a lot, because I looked in the mirror and I saw someone else staring back at me. and suddenly I didn't feel like me anymore, and that was great. And I talked like this, you know, I had this American accent and this deep voice.
And you have to have a great presence, because when she walks on down those stairs, you know, it's a wonderful moment. It's a star part, isn't it?
It is, and, you know, the decor is extraordinary and the costumes are extraordinary. There is the famous staircase, of course, which I have to descend and ascend many times during the show. And then, of course, there's the music. You know, you have to sing that stuff. And it's very different for me. It's a different kind of music for me.
And a different character, as you say. I mean, she's vain, she's selfish, mm-hmm. she's petulant, and she's ultimately pathetic, isn't she?
She's slightly off her rocker, yeah. She really is. I mean, she's deluded. But I see things in her too. You know, I think there's a backstory, and we all have our different backstories about her, and I think she was probably abandoned when she was maybe in her teens, and she's been abandoned by men, and so when finally this young man is about to abandon her, she just cannot take it anymore.
Well, you obviously ended up liking her, because now you're going to play her for a very long time, aren't
you?
Have you signed up?
I've signed up, yes. I start on the 9th of January, 96, and the idea is that I do it for a year. I mean, it won't be a straight year. I'll do it for 6 months and then take a breather, I hope.
Is it possible? It's an awful lot of performances a week.
Yes, there are 8 performances a week. I'm going to take every other Monday off so that I can get 2 nights off, you know, Sunday and Monday night off. I had a long talk with Glenn Close about it recently, and she played it on Broadway, and she said, you know, you really can't do this. You know, you can't do it for a year. Nobody can.
Tell me about record number 2.
Oh, yes, Land of My Fathers. I'm half Welsh. When I was a kid, my sister and I used to, when the bombarding was bad in London, we would be sent off to Wales to stay with our grandparents in Pentrebach. And we loved it. And I used to roam around the mountains like something out of Sound of Music. And sing. I used to sing all the time. Yes, yes.
Land of My Fathers, sung by the Morriston Orpheus Choir. So, Petula, your mother was Welsh, and it was she who taught you to sing. When was the first time you sang in public? Do you remember?
I think it was in chapel in Wales, in Pentrebach.
I thought you sang in a Bentall's department store with Harry Fry and his orchestra.
You've been doing your research, haven't you? Yes, I did. But by then I was 8 years old, you know. I mean, I'd been around for a while.
And you did impersonations, I think,
yes,
when you were quite small. Who did you impersonate?
Vera Lynn, of course. And a lady called Nellie Wallace. Richard Tauber.
And Jimmy Durante, my research.
Oh, Sophie Tucker. I mean, really.
But you were fulfilling your father's dreams in a way, weren't you? I mean, because he, I think, was a frustrated showbiz, was he? And so he really wanted this for him. How early on did he decide that you were going to be big?
Well, he heard me singing around the house. He used to work at nights, and he was trying to get some sleep during the daytime, and I was singing around the house, and he's shouted down to my mum, you know, switch the radio off. And my mother said, it's not the radio, it's Petula. And he decided that I had some talent. But, I mean, he didn't have any influence and we weren't wealthy. And he was a very good-looking man, my father. He looked like Errol Flynn. In fact, he was bitten by an Errol Flynn fan on the calf, I think it was, at some point. Don't ask me how that happened. But he had always wanted to be an actor and wasn't allowed to, so He encouraged me, shall we say. Yeah.
It was he who chose your name. Where did he get the Petula from? I mean, one's never heard it before or since, really. Have you ever met anybody else called
Petula? Oh, yes, I have. There is actually another Petula Clark around, poor soul. And there are quite a lot of ladies called Petula, and there are a lot of cows and barges named after me. I suppose it's a compliment, I don't know.
But where did he get the name from?
He made it up. He made it up out of two ex-girlfriends. I don't know if that's true, but...
But by 1942, you were singing on the radio in wartime programmes. It's All Yours, I think, was the first one, wasn't it?
Yes, it's a show that used to go out for the troops serving overseas.
And wasn't there a time when you calmed everybody down in an air raid?
Yes. That was my first radio show. It was at the Criterion Theatre. We were recording this show for the troops. It consisted of kids who would go along and send messages to their uncles, fathers, brothers serving overseas. And I had an uncle who was serving out in the desert somewhere. And I went along to send my message. And in the middle of rehearsal, there was a gigantic air raid. We were right in the middle of London. It's a Piccadilly Circus, the Criterion. And everything had to stop. And the producer said, well, somebody come up and say a piece of poetry or sing a song, just, you know, calm everyone down. And nobody else volunteered, so I went up and sang.
What did you sing?
Mighty Like a Rose. And I sang it into the microphone, and just like in the movies, they heard it in the control room. And they seemed to be quite impressed, and they said, well, would you like to sing a song as well as send your message? And so I said, yes, you know. And that's the first time I was heard on the air, and there was an enormous reaction to it. Sort of from then on, I became... Well, just as Vera Lynn was the Forces' sweetheart, I was the Forces' little girl. I represented all the kids who'd been left behind.
And you went on, you sang in the Albert Hall, and then you got your own radio programme, Pet's Parlour.
Yes.
But what sort of effect did it have on you? Did you just take it all in your stride? I mean, obviously, if you're the sort of kid who could get up and perform, you just took to it easily, or...?
I'm really basically very, very shy, I think, like a lot of performers are. And getting up and singing sort of got me over my shyness, I think.
But there's a story that you would sit backstage, even at the Albert Hall, reading a comic, you know, just sort of quietly waiting to go on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then sort of dog-ear the comic as I went on stage and go on, pull the place down and come back to my comic, you know. Yes, those were the days. Now
but
they
how
really
could you,
have to push me up that ramp.
How could you do that? I mean, it must have taken great guts. You must have been a very unusual little girl.
Well, I think children are fearless anyway, you know.
You just do what you had to do, I suppose.
Of course, yeah.
Record number three.
Oh, yes, one of my favourite singers, Annie Lennox. I remember when I first heard this track, No More I Love Yous, I think I was in Atlanta in a record store, and this was being played in the store. And I stopped dead in my tracks and thought, what is that? I just think she's brilliant, this lady.
Annie Lennox and No More I Love Yous.
I love it.
It was a very topsy-turvy business, really, your growing up, wasn't it? Because at the age of 10, you were supposed to be grown up enough to go to work, as it were. But by the time you got into your teens, 17 and 18, they were kind of binding your chest and putting on ankle socks to try and keep you young.
Yeah.
Must have been very confusing.
It was. I was not a very happy lady at that time, no. Well, I suppose, I was under contract to the Rank organisation and I'd been in quite a lot of films and was quite popular, I suppose, and I was more valuable to them as a child than as a teenager. In those days, adolescence wasn't what it is today, you know, it wasn't exploited the way it is now, and it was difficult, because I think, but the last thing you want to do when you're getting a little bit of shape to you is to cover it up.
Is it true that you came close to having a nervous breakdown? Did you?
Yes, it is true, yeah. I think I know I got close to having a breakdown, and I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't talk to anyone about it, and I kind of got myself through it.
What about your father? Because he was your full-time manager, really, mm-hmm. wasn't he? I mean, was he sympathetic at all to that, or did he...
I don't think he was even aware that it was going on. Quite honestly.
Didn't you talk to him about it?
No. I didn't talk to anyone about it. It was a very, very difficult time for me. I had a year of great stress, and, well, I think I'm okay, you know. But
you tried, didn't you? You tried to sort of grow up. You tried. I think once I remember some story of your singing a sexy song on the television and the nation rose up.
Yes, I remember the song. It was called When the World Was Young. It was a wonderful song that Peggy Lee recorded. I adored Peggy Lee, still do. It had a line in it, lying in the hay, games we used to play. I probably didn't even know what that meant, you know. And I sang it on television because I thought it was a beautiful song. And oh, dear. Dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Our pet getting sexy.
Oh, what's this? What's this?
But your father ran you completely, did he? He chose your songs and he chose your frocks and he told you what to do and you did it.
Yes, I worshipped my dad, you know, I just adored him. That was fine, it all went very well until I started having some ideas of my own. I wanted to make my own mistakes. And I made them, eventually.
But you didn't leave home, did you, till about the age of 25,
that's
I
right.
think you finally finally got out.
Yes.
Was it a kind of escape?
I think it was, yes. It was a very difficult time for me and for my father. And, you know, I loved him very dearly, but the time had come. And it was just a difficult situation because I was never quite sure anymore who I was talking to. I was talking to my father, I was talking to my manager. And once I had left it, things... But they were difficult for a while, but then they improved, you know. He realised that I had to do it.
And once you left, you got a flat in London and a little red sports car. And
pink.
And life began, did it?
Kind of, yes. But it wasn't easy, you know. I didn't have that support anymore. But I was having a good time, in a way.
Next piece of music.
Goretzky's... That's Symphony Number 3, sung by Dawn Upshaw. She is incredible. Now, that is a wonderful voice. This is the kind of voice that I would love to have if I was going to sing this kind of thing. This is the way I would like to sing. It's very pure and very, very moving.
Part of Goretzky's Symphony No. 3, sung by Dawn Upshaw with the London Sinfonietta, conducted by David Zinman. So it was the late 50s, Petula Clark, you went to France on a tour and met a man called Claude. It was kind of love at first sight, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It wasn't really a tour. I went there for one night, and I had been talked into that. I did not want to go to France. I didn't speak any French. I had the most dreadful cold, I remember. I went over. Eventually, they talked me into going over to do this one night at the Olympia, which is a bit like the Palladium over here. And I could virtually almost not sing. I mean, I went to a doctor in the afternoon who gave me a very strange kind of remedy for my voice. I won't go into it on the radio. You know what the French are like. And I was totally shocked by the whole thing. What am I doing here? Anyway, the remedy worked, and I went on, and I sang, and they loved it. They just thought it was wonderful. The French audience went crazy. I never really understood why. And the next morning, I was in the office of the recording boss over there, Vogue Records, and he was trying to talk me into recording in French. I had no desire to record in French. All I wanted to do was get out of there. And the lights went off. It's a bit like in the studio. If the lights went off, we'd be in total darkness, right? There were no windows. So this guy called something out in French, and this young man staggered into the room, stood on the desk and changed the light bulb. And the light went on. And there he was. And I said to this boss man, I said, who is this? You know, and he said, this is Claude Wolff. You know, he is our public relations, and he will be taking you around the studios, you know, and meeting the people all over Paris if you come back with a record in French, you know.
So you signed immediately.
I said, oh, well, okay, I'll think about this. And 3 weeks later, I was back there with my first record in very bad French, may I say.
And Claude was the guy, and that was it. And you married, and you went to live there.
It took me 18 months to get him.
Did it?
Yes.
But you got him in the end.
I got him, yeah.
But so when you went over there, I mean, you began, that was when you really began to grow up, as we said at the beginning. You were kind of liberated. So not just your professional life changed, your personal life changed, everything, didn't it? Yeah. And your style of singing changed, because you've been very much brought up in the sort of British music hall tradition of sequins and the big ballad.
Yes.
Tell me about the French influence on you then, professionally.
Oh, well, I remember going to the music hall for the first time in Paris, and I saw Piaf. And I thought, well, what's all this about? You know, this little lady comes out in this rather shabby little black dress and sings about death and madness and sex and all kinds of, you know, heavy stuff. And this isn't music hall, you know. And I'd never seen anything like that before. And, of course, she's not the only one. There was Aznavour, obviously, but there are many, many singers like that. And it just sort of taught me so much.
But a fascinating thing that within, what, 2 or 3 years, you had beaten Piaf to that top place in the French estimation. You were the number one female vocalist in France.
Yes, it was amazing, really. I never really understood how that happened. But I had some very good songs, and I was working with some marvellous people.
But were you happy? Did it all make you happy? Yes. Did you suddenly think, now I'm living?
I was extremely happy. I was working very hard. And, of course, by then I had 2 children, two girls. And it was hard work.
What did your father think of all this success?
He was very pleased. I think he realised after a while that this was very good for me as a person and as a performer. And he grew to like Claude a lot.
But it was difficult for him at first.
Yes, because Claude's a very strong man.
I suppose the one man replaced the other in your life, didn't he?
Yes.
Or is that too much pop psychology?
I think it's very true.
Yeah. Next piece of music.
Quincy Jones. Talking about my French career, I mean, I was really very busy, and then suddenly in 64, Tony Hatch came along with a song called Downtown, and it became a hit here, and then it became a huge hit in the States. And there I was being sucked into American show business, and it was very, very exciting. But it just complicated my life so much, because I was already very busy in France. So when America called, I mean, it was difficult for me to get there, you know, physically to get there. But once I got there, that was incredible. And I learned a lot there too, and I learned a lot from Quincy. I got to work with him, and he's just an amazing man.
Quincy Jones and Birdland. So you were a great hit in the States, and Downtown was followed by Don't Sleep in the Subway. And
I Know a Place.
I Know a Place.
Yes.
And I Couldn't Live Without Your Love. I mean, they rolled on, didn't they?
Lots of numbers.
Lots of them. But you'd also had these babies, as you say, and all of this was happening in the 60s, and you were making films. How did you cope domestically? I mean, it must have been agonising.
I thought I was coping quite well, but I wanted it all. I wanted the career, and I wanted a good marriage and a good family life, and I think having a good career is a full-time job, and having a good personal life is a full-time job, and 2 full-time jobs, that's rough.
You did try once, didn't you, giving up professionally and taking to domesticity? What happened?
Yes. I got very bored and very boring, apparently. Let's face it, you know, I started this when I was very young. I didn't know how to do anything else. But the 2 years were good. I had wonderful times with the children, and they have wonderful memories of their childhood.
But you were really trying to be superwoman, as you say. You were
yes,
trying
I
to
was.
Be the perfect wife, the perfect mother, and the perfect professional performer.
And the press liked talking about it, saying, oh, you know, she's doing this, and she can do this, and she can do that, and that you see it can be done. And I'm not sure that it can be done, you know. I sometimes have a feeling that if I'd concentrated all my energies on my career, I would have done a lot better. And certainly I know that if I'd concentrated all my energies on my family, I would have done a lot better so, with that.
Why are you so certain of that?
I think it's a marvellous thing to be a good wife and mother. I admire it very much, and I don't think I did it very well. I did what I could, but, I was trying to do too much.
So of the three roles, you think you were best at being the professional performer, were you? To the detriment of the other two.
Yeah, but you see, I have a wonderful relationship with my family, and we talk about this quite a bit. And they have only marvellous memories of their childhood, and we are very, very close, probably a lot closer than most. And so I guess it wasn't that bad after all.
Record number 6.
I've met some really great people through the years of my career. I've sung with some great people too, and I sing often with Michael McDonald. I think he's just one of the greatest pop singers of them all.
Michael McDonald and the Doobie Brothers and What a Fool Believes. Your children are grown up now, Petula. They're in their 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Your marriage is more than 35 years old, but you live separate lives, really, don't you?
Yes, we do. I mean, but we'll be spending Christmas together, you know. Well, my husband and I will be spending Christmas together. The kids will be doing their own separate things, but, yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it? The business of marriage is sort of moving apart a bit, you know. But you've obviously found a way of going on. You don't want a divorce.
I think marriage is a very difficult thing. It's wonderful, but even when it's wonderful, it's not easy. And I'm in a very demanding kind of profession. And we live apart in a way, but in a way, some strange sort of way it works. You know, that's difficult to explain to people.
Well, I think if you have so much history, which you have, it's very difficult suddenly to be totally apart, isn't it? You remain friends. Does he still advise you professionally and so on?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And he's always there at the important moments. Sure.
But you do live separate lives. I mean, would you like someone to come in and whisk you off your feet and make you feel special again?
Well, the nice thing about my life at the moment is that I'm coping very well on my own. And I've done a lot of growing up over the last few years, although I don't think I'll ever grow up entirely. And I'm not sure that I want to grow up entirely. I think that, you know, I still find life wonderful, and I get excited about things, and I'm still learning.
But professionally, I mean, we've looked back across a long and incredibly successful career of yours.
I've had a few ups and downs.
But you said to me during some music just now that you didn't really feel you'd done very much. Can that be true?
I have to say, I don't think I've done anything particularly remarkable, you know. I think the best is yet to come. I hope so.
Record number 7.
Okay. One of my trips to Canada, I think it was to Montreal, I was being interviewed, and this guy said to me, and how do you feel about Glenn Gould passing away? I didn't realize he died, and he had just died a few days before. And he said, well, how do you feel about it? I said, well, yes, that's very sad, because he was really brilliant. He said, yes, but you know he was a great fan of yours. I said, you're kidding me, aren't you? And he played me this tape and showed me some cuttings of Glenn Gould. And this marvellous genius was a Pet Clark fan, which I found rather extraordinary. Thank you.
one of Bach's Goldberg variations played by Glenn Gould. So what about this Christmas, Petula? Where will you be? What are you doing?
Well, I'm going to be on the QE2 in the Caribbean.
What, doing concerts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be doing a couple of concerts on the QE2 and having my turkey and my Christmas pudding at last, because you see, in France, you don't get any of that stuff. Well, maybe you'll get a little bit of dinde, you know, a little bit of turkey with a bit of foie gras. No Christmas pudding. I usually turn up to the chalet in France with my own little Christmas pudding, which I eat on my own, because they all think that Christmas pudding is hysterical, you know.
So you've missed your good English traditional Christmas over all these years.
I have, yes.
What about when you did have the big family Christmases and so on? Didn't you cook the turkey then?
Yes, but, you know, they would turn their noses up at it mostly. You know, we'd finish up going out somewhere, you know, to have a proper meal afterwards. You know.
Well, that isn't Christmas, is it?
No, I know it's not, but they don't understand it, you see. You cannot teach the French about Christmas.
And what I wonder, here's a difficult question, here's the most difficult question of all. What will be your New Year's resolution when the moment comes?
To really be happy without hurting anybody else. I've got a few ideas of, you know, things that make me happy. I really want to try to help out with the refugees. I've done a lot of work with UNICEF and the UN with the refugees, but it's becoming such an enormous problem. And I've really, to make myself happy, I've got to do something about that. I don't quite know what, but something's going to have to be done.
Last record.
I think on this island I would like to have something that I could listen to at night under the stars, and Mozart's The Man.
Part of the second movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 in C major, played by the London Mozart Players, conducted by Howard Shelley. Now, which one of those eight records, Petula, if you could only take one?
Oh, Mozart.
Mozart, the man.
Definitely, yeah.
Right. Mm. What about your book? You've got the Bible, you've got Shakespeare.
Mm. I need something funny, because I really like to laugh. Maybe a chum's book, you know, like Peter Ustinov, you know. Because he's a wonderful man. I've spent many marvellous hours with him. He works a lot with the UN as well. So, yeah, something by Ustinov.
And your luxury?
My piano. I have a lovely piano, which is now in Miami.
Grand? Baby grand?
A baby black grand. White. An extraordinary piano. It's 1925, and the black keys are painted gold, my dear. It's very, very beautiful. It's a lovely piece of furniture, and it's a fairly good piano, but it's just got a lot of heart and soul to it, and I would love to have that. And I could do some songwriting.
Petula Clark, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs, and happy Christmas.
And same to you.